From the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, this is Audiophiles. I'm your host, Ellie Yu, and on today's show, we're talking about long shots. That's people beating the odds, rebuilding from the ground up, and finally filling some big shoes. We'll hear about a Brooklyn resident's quest to name a street after a local legend.
This is where it started for Christopher Wallace, a.k.a. Biggie Smalls.
And we'll hear about what it takes to make it to the Olympics.
It's not about money. It symbolizes, like, being the best at what you do, and everybody wants that.
Plus, indie rock artist Our Guys joins us in the studio for a live performance. A year ago this month, Hurricane Sandy flooded the Bruckner Bar and Grill in the South Bronx, and it's been closed ever since. The Bruckner was more than just a neighborhood pub in the area. It gave local artists a chance to show their work. Audiophiles reporter Alex Eidman found out why the bar's closing left such a big hole in this neighborhood.
It's Sunday morning, and Cynthia Casado is outside the Bruckner Bar and Grill in New York's South Bronx neighborhood. Born and raised nearby, Casado started working as a waitress at the bar in 2006.
I was really into, like, getting to know the people and knowing what their likes was. So if and when they came back, I knew that what they wanted was, like, mozzarella sticks.
She quickly found that the Bruckner was more than just a place to drink. It became her community and the nexus of a growing creative scene that popped up under the Third Avenue Bridge.
It just kind of took off. And just to give you an idea of, like, the kind of patronage that we would have, it was just like people that lived upstairs or that lived across the street in the lofts. And they were like my friends. I knew who they were. They would tip me well. It was nice, you know, slowly but surely. Everybody who worked here was a performance artist or a painter or some type of sculptor.
The back room of the Bruckner became a sort of salon with poetry, music, live nude model drawings, and comedy. Casado, who goes by the stage name Cindy Sugar Rush, says her stand-up career blossomed in that back room.
If it's not a little shock that I'm a Puerto Rican and Dominican mix, because, you know, they say they don't get along, but obviously that's a myth, because I got like 14 brothers and sisters.
I grew here as a performer. Like, when everybody thought I was down and out, the Bruckner gave me an opportunity to bring my show through, and it was very successful.
Across the street from the Bruckner, people are filing into the Clock Bar for happy hour. Mike Brady is the owner and manager of the Clock and a South Bronx resident. Before he opened the bar, the Bruckner was his hangout, too. He spent a lot of hours studying the Bruckner crowd over a beer.
You know, the Bruckner's taught us you really have to pay attention to the community that we live in and treat the community well.
The Bruckner inspired Brady to start his own place. Rather than be competitors, the Clock and the Bruckner worked together to keep up with the changing neighborhood.
I think for so long, particularly this area of the South Bronx, was neglected, and the community should have never been neglected. The Clock Bar was the first to host an LGBT event. We worked with Tandem with the Bruckner to start hosting more LGBT events in the neighborhood, because there's a huge population that was neglected.
Just as these collaborative events were gaining steam, Hurricane Sandy struck.
A Mott Haven institution has officially closed its doors for good. The Bruckner Bar and Grill, right off of the 3rd Avenue Bridge, was hit hard by Superstorm Sandy. They posted on the bar's Facebook page, quote, "By the way it looks, we won't be opening soon."
When we came in, and the basement was completely flooded.
That's Joseph Diaz, manager at the Bruckner. He remembers the scene the day after the storm.
Everything in the basement was turned upside down, all the freezers, refrigerators, everything, all the food, beers, liquor, everything was destroyed. We had a wood floor, which completely got damaged. We had to rip up. We had to tear down walls. We had to redo the whole basement because of the mold.
The repairs took months. On top of that, the Bruckner's former owner and the landlord of the building waged a legal battle over costs. A year later, it's still closed.
I get text messages every week from customers asking when we're going to reopen.
Local city council member Maria del Carmen Arroyo is one of the loyal customers waiting for some good news.
Can we expect it to be the way it was? I think that would be unrealistic. So we need to provide the establishment an opportunity to reposition itself in the community.
The Bruckner is hoping its fans won't have to wait much longer. The bar is now under new ownership. When it gets its final liquor license approval, it can once again open its doors. When it does, it will have the support of the community it helped create behind it. In the South Bronx, I'm Alex Eidman. Sometimes you wanna go
where everybody knows your name. You're listening to Audio Files. I'm your host, Ellie Yu. Today, we're rooting for underdogs everywhere. A Brooklyn resident is looking to name a street after hip-hop legend, the Notorious B.I.G. The effort began earlier this fall, and an online petition has already gathered thousands of signatures. Tiffany Kamhai went to Clinton Hill to talk to supporters and check out the rapper's old stomping ground.
In the early 90s, the East Coast hip-hop scene couldn't find the rhymes to compete with West Coast rappers like Dr. Dre and Tupac Shakur. That is until the Notorious B.I.G., or Biggie Smalls, came on the scene in 1994. I'm blowing up like you thought I would. Call a crib, same number, same hood. It's all good. He changed the game with his mixture of complex rhymes and smooth flows. But his rise to hip-hop royalty ended abruptly in 1997, after he was killed in a drive-by shooting. Biggie Smalls, also known by his given name Christopher Wallace, grew up in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn. The neighborhood has changed a lot since Wallace lived there, from violent streets and drug hustlers to baby strollers and chic shops. But the residents still see Wallace as one of its most beloved sons.
He put Brooklyn on the map through his music. I can't say that about a lot of other rappers that come from this neighborhood, you know. He's a trendsetter.
He just knows, like, what to say in his music, and it was really inspiring. You know, his beats, his lyrics, everything was just so, so nice. And I love him. I love Biggie, even today, to this day.
If you're really from Brooklyn, if you're a Brooklyn kid, you represented hard. And that's what Christopher Wallace did everywhere he went.
That's Leroy McCarthy. He came up with the idea to co-name the corner of Fulton Street and St. James Place after the rapper. He wants to call it Christopher Wallace Way.
He is somebody who has went to legendary status, such as Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Marley, and he is still relevant today. People still wear his T-shirt as if they're going to his concert. So he has touched a nerve in society from 1994 through to now with his music.
The street corner has become an unofficial landmark for the neighborhood. Walking tours stop there, and tourists use the street for photo ops. But even though the block is recognized internationally for its former hip-hop resident, that's not enough to co-name a street. That's according to Community Board 2 District Manager Rob Paris.
The honor should be reserved for people that have really had a significant impact and a significant impact within the district. It's not just about were you great. It's were you great here.
In the past 10 years, only 5 streets have been co-named after influential figures, including abolitionist Harriet Tubman, the first African-American councilwoman, Mary Pinkett, and firefighter Sean Powell, who died on 9/11.
These are the kind of seminal figures that the community board feels belong up on a signpost, not someone who was active in their church or led a block association for many years. Those are great things, and we need those people in the community, but we don't necessarily need to name a street for them.
But many local residents, like Shawnee's Ford, say Wallace deserves that honor.
Even though Biggie Smalls wasn't a political leader or a reverend, I do believe that he was a street mogul for youngsters back in our time. I know we were the same age, and he taught me a lot about the streets and what's happening in the streets.
Wallace often rapped about the culture of street violence, and many believe his death was a direct result of gang involvement. His past could pose a problem for city officials, who fear the street renaming might glorify the violence in his music. But Leroy McCarthy says many of Wallace's songs were motivational, like Sky's the Limit, which chronicles his rags-to-riches story. Need no man, stay far from timid, only make moves when your heart's in it, and live to pray, sky's the limit. And McCarthy says hip-hop artists are constantly underplayed in New York.
They got walks of fame all over the place, but they leave out hip-hop on a regular basis. And to get a street named after Christopher Wallace, I think would be a great homage to what he has contributed to New York City.
So far, there's only one New York street co-named in honor of hip-hop. Run DMC, JMJ Way, and Hollis Queens. And there's still a lot of red tape to cut through before Christopher Wallace Way can become a reality. After the proposal passes the community board, it goes on to a final round of hearings from City Council. In Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, I'm Tiffany Kamheim. Leroy McCarthy recently brought his petition to the community board, but some residents are blocking the effort. You're listening to Audio Files, and I'm LEU. If you've ever been to a Comic-Con, you might have bumped into Wonder Woman or a costumed female fan. But you probably didn't see too many women manning a booth or moderating a panel. That's because the world of comics is still mostly a boys' club. G. Willow Wilson, author of the comic book series Air and Mystic and graphic novel Cairo, is bucking that trend. She joins us here today to talk about women in comic book writing. Hi, Willow. Welcome to Audio Files.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So we want to talk to you about women in comics, both authors and artists, as well as female characters portrayed in comics. I heard there's a test that actually can measure this. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's called the Bechdel test, after graphic novelist Alison Bechdel, who did the famous two very well-received graphic memoirs, Fun Home, and a second one that came out a couple of years ago. And, you know, as a feminist, she was interested in representations of women in comics and film. And so she came up with a test to sort of see if women included in comics and film were actually fulfilling legitimate roles. And so there's a bunch of different questions, you know, including does the female character have her own story arc, or is she just, you know, like a sidekick who's only there to support a male character? So, you know, it's something that has become kind of a byword in the industry, to sort of make sure that women who are represented in comics and in film are there, you know, for their own reasons, and are there to legitimately represent women and not just sort of as set dressing for male characters.
And do you think comic books usually pass this test?
You know, that is kind of the question of the day, and it's a very sticky issue right now in the comic book world, because one does see female characters, I think, increasingly often in comic books. You know, they play roles in a lot of these group comics that are becoming more popular, like the Avengers. Of course, there was, you know, Scarlett Johansson portrayed Black Widow in the film version, you know, that came out to a lot of success last year or the year before. But there's also, you know, there's still a complaint that even though the readership of comics is increasingly female, it's rare to see a comic book series headed by a female character take top billing in terms of sales and exposure. So there's still quite a gap. And, you know, it's sort of a catch-22, because, of course, you know, in the industry, the thought is, well, female readers will read a comic headlined by a male character and also a comic headlined by a female character, but male readers are less likely to pick up comics headlined by female characters. So it's a big issue in the comic book scene right now.
And why do you think that is?
You know, that is kind of the $10 million question, and it's been batted around many a time at both in conventions on panels about women in comics and also on blogs and kind of in the fan universe. And people have different explanations. You know, one of them is that for a long time, comics was kind of a male-dominated industry, that if you go into a comic book store, it's kind of geared toward hardcore fans who tend to be you know, men who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s. And so people who aren't from that demographic might feel a little bit overwhelmed. There's also a thought that, you know, because a lot of female fans tend to gravitate towards stuff like manga, which you can get in mainstream bookstores, that they're less likely to go and pick up superhero comic books, which are usually only carried in specialty stores. So, you know, there's a question of access. Do people know where to pick up these books? And there's also a question of, you know, do female fans feel welcome? Do they feel like they're being represented, and like the stories that are being told are, you know, in these comic books are something that they relate to? So, you know, there is no hard and fast answer. And it's something that I think the industry as a whole is really struggling with.
Right. I read a stat somewhere that 40% of attendees of New York Comic Con, which happened recently, were women. But out of 274 special guests there, only one woman was in the group they called spotlight guests.
That would not surprise me. I have not seen that exact statistic, but that sounds about right. And it's really true. And it goes back to that whole thing, you know, that I mentioned just now about, you know, sort of the composition of the fan world. And, you know, female fans tend to pick up, you know, a really wide swath of books, and they'll quite happily read books centered on male characters. And so even though the fan community is nearly half female, it seems as though a lot of publishers hesitate to take a chance on books headlined by female characters, for the simple reason that, you know, they know that the female fans will pick it up, but they're less sure that male fans will be interested in it, because that willingness to kind of you know, to read books that involve headlining characters that are not of your own gender only seems to cut one way, you know. But it's not all completely grim. It does seem to be changing. You know, there are certain characters now that are certain female characters that are getting really dedicated fan bases. So, it could be that it's a matter of time.
Sure. And I want to ask you now, I know you wrote a comic book series, Aaron Mystic, and the graphic novel Cairo. Have you experienced any of that with your readership?
You know, I've been really lucky in that the reactions to my books have you know, been really encouraging and positive. Mystic, which was a young adult book that I wrote several years ago that actually got an Eisner nomination, is about two lead female characters. And so it's very much a story of teen girls and, you know, rivalries and the academic world. It's sort of a kind of a female Harry Potter type of book set in a fantasy alternate universe. A lot of people that I talked to, including a lot of guys, expressed a lot of gratitude. You know, a lot of these guy fans who've been reading comics since they were kids now have children of their own, including daughters. And so this is becoming a concern of theirs, that now they want books that they can give to their daughters, that have role models that they can aspire to be, you know, that are strong and are not only valued for their bodies, but have their own character arcs going on. You know, so in Mystic, we really tried to kind of hit that note.
Now, I want to ask you, how did you get into comics?
Well, comics were something that I wanted to be involved in ever since I was old enough to figure out that there were people making comics and they didn't just sort of magically appear on the shelves. You know, when I was a teenager, Vertigo, which is the literary, you know, more adult imprint of DC Comics, had just been launched, and they were doing these amazing fantasy titles that were geared toward, you know, a more literary audience, and I was just totally enthralled. And so I started paying closer attention to the industry and to kind of how all the pieces fit together in terms of writers and artists and editors. And I was very lucky to intern in college with one of the very first digital comic book companies, which was called Comic Works. It was kind of 10 years ahead of its time because nobody had a tablet back then. There were no tablet computers. And so it ended up closing its doors. But through that, I managed to meet just a wonderful cross-section of people working in all segments of the industry, both as writers and artists and editors and administrators. And those contacts were really valuable to me when I started writing scripts of my own, because I had mentors I could show them to and ask for advice.
That's great. I will have to leave it here today. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can follow Willow on Twitter at G Willow Wilson. You're listening to Audiophiles. Next, we take you along on the journey to the Olympics. It's a path with hurdles, twists, and turns, even for seasoned athletes. But what if your sport is something you've never done before and have only 8 months to prepare? In Lake Placid, New York, Audiophiles reporter Kathleen Culleton tracks the swift curves in the life of one underdog bobsledder.
Phaedra Knight looks down the bobsled run on top of Mount Hovenberg. She remembers her sled whizzing down the track. The pilot missed a curve, and the bobsled skipped and jumped.
At that point, it's all about bicep curls. It's all about holding me in, keeping my head protected, because the sled actually did roll over.
That's Knight, strong when other people would let go. Knight is a retired professional rugby player, awarded USA Player of the Decade in 2010. Last February, she decided to train for the women's Olympic bobsled team. Knight was then 38 years old, and she'd never set foot in a bobsled before. She had just 8 months before trials to transform herself into a contender.
I muscled through my rugby career. This is something actually that I have to do the exact opposite. I have to let go and let my power flow.
1 month before the selection race would begin in Lake Placid, Knight walks into the small apartment in Queens where her masseuse, Barbara, has set up shop. Knight's been training hard since launching her campaign. She's trying to turn the body of a rugby player into the body of a bobsledder. She gives Barbara a rundown of what she's been working on.
Basically, I told her I was a fat ass. No, I'm not kidding. I'm kidding, but not. Brooks is awesome.
That's Brooks Johnson, her sprinting coach.
What he identified was that I wasn't able to bring my heels close enough to my butt.
As Barbara works on stretching out Knight's hip flexors, Knight tries to explain to her exactly what her body must do.
You and your driver sync up. From there, you go. So you fall into the push, and you sprint as fast as you can.
So you're doing like this.
Barbara works with Olympians, ballet dancers, and professional athletes of all kinds. After the massage, she gives a prognosis. Today, it's good news.
I'm noticing a lot better range of motion and a lot less limitation just from muscle bulk.
Barbara is just one member of the team trying to get Knight to the Olympics. She's got a sprinting coach, a chiropractor, a weight training coach, a wellness coach, and a coach to manage all coaching. They are turning her into an Olympian, but they come at a cost. On a chilly October night in New York City, Knight strikes a pose for photographers. Clad in a black tux, she's on the red carpet into the Women's in Sports Foundation dinner, and she's on a mission.
And part of this whole process is to try to build my sports celebrity to a magnitude that I am a household name.
She's not media obsessed. She needs the money. Bobsledding is one of the most expensive Olympic sports to compete in.
Yeah, I'm the best of the best, but savings doesn't exist. Savings was all the money I spent.
Sleds cost anywhere from $30,000 to $100,000, plus training expenses and travel. Knight estimates getting to Sochi will cost $150,000.
There's just not a lot of money in bobsledding. And being a female on top of it, it's tough.
The day after the Women's Sports Foundation dinner, not only is there no mention of the event in the New York Times sports section, there's no mention of women. At all. There's a picture of five first grade girls whose teacher is also a basketball coach. That's it. It's this lack of media attention that keeps most bobsledders poor. The sport never gets on TV, so there's no airtime to sell to sponsors. And as many as make it drop out because they can't afford to play. But for Knight, that's what makes the Olympics so alluring.
It's not about money. It symbolizes, like, being the best at what you do. And everybody wants that.
And to race day on Mount Van Hohenberg, Olympic year.
Back at Lake Placid, the contenders unload their sleds on the top of the Mount Hovenberg run. Bobsledding is a blue-collar sport. You do your own lifting. The women wear skin-tight bodysuits, and they all carry helmets. All except Knight. She's wearing workout pants and fleece. She's not going to run. Despite months of training and campaigning, Knight's timing is one half of a second too slow. That means when it comes time for the pilots to choose a brakeman or woman, Knight doesn't make the cut.
I was really disappointed, but it was the first time I'd done it. This is going to be a process.
8 months ago, Knight was an outsider, with her eye on the 2014 Winter Olympics. Last week, she was skidding down the track, risking life and limb for a dream she didn't get. Today, she's a member of an Olympic team. She earned a position as an alternate.
Yeah, it's awesome going fast. It's awesome jumping in a sled and cruising down the track. It's awesome to compete.
Finally, I know she's on the right track, even if it is longer than she thought, and as slick as ice. Reporting from Lake Placid, New York, I'm Kathleen Culleton.
We'll be back.
This is Audiophiles. I'm your host, Ellie Yu. The MacArthur Genius Grants are awarded each year to people who are, well, geniuses, those who have done exceptional work in their fields. I'm here with one of those winners. Dr. Sarah Seeger is a professor of physics and planetary science at MIT. She's also been encouraging women to pursue the STEM fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. Welcome to Audiophiles. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ellie. It's great to be here.
So I know you're an astrophysicist and planetary scientist. Could you tell us what that means to people who may not be familiar with science?
Sure. In my case, I study planets and what they're made of and what their atmospheres look like. And I do this primarily by using computer codes that I or people on my team write ourselves. And we use physics, equations that are well known or have been known for decades, and we write them in a code and we try to predict what exoplanets would be like, planets made of very different materials than our Earth or other planets in our solar system. And we also take data from the Hubble Space Telescope and other telescopes and try to interpret what is in their atmosphere in terms of gases and composition.
How did you decide to get into the field you're in?
Well, it was somewhat accidental, although as a child I really loved astronomy. And when I was about 16 years old, first of all, when I was a teenager I was not ultra nerdy. I had my kind of party phase. Once that died down a little, I actually realized I went to an open house at my local university, and I realized you could be an astronomer for a job, and I was so excited. It was one of the most exciting days of my life, until my father, who was actually a feminist before his time, he just said, no, that's not going to work out. You need to not rely on any man. You need a job where you can support yourself. So he was very discouraging. He didn't want me to go on some job. He didn't know what it was or whether I could get a job. But at the end of the day, I realized, this is the advice I give people now, and somehow I already knew it back then. Find something you love doing that you're really good at doing. And if you have that combination, it's magical, and then you will succeed.
And in college and graduate school, did you see many women in your field?
Well, in undergraduate, there was a lack of women. And in my university in particular, University of Toronto, at that time, and that was 20 years ago, so there had never been a female physics professor ever at the university. And so it was so startling to me when I came for an interview at graduate school to meet a woman professor. She was young. You know, it was like something like, wow, that could be me. So it's empowering to have some role models out there. But at the time, I didn't have any, and there were not very many women.
I mean, that's still the case today. A lot of, you know, women aren't going into the STEM fields as much as men are. Do you think there's anything that we, you know, as parents, the media, educators, family, should do to encourage girls to pursue these fields?
I think there is, but I think it's most important not to discourage them. Like, I was at this gathering the other day, and there was a mother, and she was almost making fun of her daughter, who was doing something she thought was so ultra nerdy. And I was thinking, oh my God, we always do stuff like that. You know, so I think sometimes just not acting like, okay, you're a little weird here, just sort of accepting them that that's your interest, it's cool. Because the stuff people do who really like science that we do in our free time, a lot of people just think it's ridiculous, but that's who they are. And so I think if you have a child or a girl or a teenager or a college student, just go along with it.
I want to talk a little bit more about your MacArthur Genius Grant now. Did you expect anything like this? You know, what do you think it was about your work that attracted?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say I definitely didn't expect it. I just sort of get my work done and try to do problems I like doing that I think are important. I think what attracted them was that my work was really pioneering, in that when I worked on exoplanets initially, very few people were working on the field. It was almost like repulsive, like they stayed away from it. And so I was so privileged and fortunate to be able to choose problems that were not ever done before and to work in a new field at the forefront. It was exciting to me, and I didn't like being in the fray with all the competition anyway, so I always tried to stay ahead of the curve. And I think when I look back now, when the MacArthur Foundation looked back, and you know, I got to be one of the people who got to literally lay the foundation for part of a new field. And I think that's what it was.
That's Professor Sarah Seeger, Professor of Physics and Planetary Science at MIT. Thank you.
Thanks. It was great being here.
Coming up on the show, we'll hear from a local undefeated college football team, and we'll go live in the studio with the band Our Guys. That's all after the break.
Okay, so just type the job website address here. That's it. Then you enter what job you're looking for there.
Electrician.
This is Peter. Recently, he got help going on the internet for the first time to look for a new job.
Okay, then you just hit search and...
In the past, Peter's gotten work through people he knew, but he heard there were more jobs online.
There we go.
These are all for me?
Uh-huh.
Really?
He had no idea just how many.
I can't believe it. This one looks good.
Peter is thinking the internet might be for him after all.
And this is just one website.
Wow. Why didn't I do this sooner?
See what the internet can help you do at everyoneon.org or call 1-855-387-9166 to find a free training class near you. Brought to you by Connect, Compete, and the Ad Council.
In a drug court in Brooklyn, offenders have two choices: get help or go to jail. Addicts can often face a long road ahead, but one man is helping them rebound through the sport of basketball. Topher Forges has the latest story in our City in Demand series.
Rasheen Little always knew he wanted to play basketball professionally. And he was good, too. So good that it became his way out of the Fort Greene projects.
Well, growing up there and going to school back in the 80s, we seen crack vials every day going to school, a lot of shooting. That was one of the things that pushed me to strive to go get a degree.
He played ball at Ventura College, where he earned his associate's degree in 2003. He later got a scholarship to the University of Montevallo in Alabama, where he played Division II. But when he graduated in 2006, the NBA didn't call, and Little returned to Brooklyn.
So I wound up having a baby, having no job, started hustling. I was going back and forth to the projects, doing things I had no business doing.
And that thing that he had no business doing was selling crack cocaine, small bags of it for 10 or 20 bucks a pop. One day, in March 2011, Little handed one of those bags to an undercover police officer.
It was a early morning, Sunday morning at that. And I just really couldn't remember too much of what could happen, because once they started putting their hands and feet on me, man, my brain and everything just went blank. Next thing you know, I was waking up. I was inside a Warhol hospital, handcuffed to the bed, face all busted up, all crazy, getting ready to see a judge the next day.
They gave Little two choices, 1 to 3 years in jail or 8 months to a year in the Brooklyn Treatment Court. The Brooklyn Treatment Court was started by Judge Joanne Ferdinand in 1996 as an alternative to jail time for nonviolent drug offenders. Ferdinand says before that, the courts were overrun, especially in the late 80s and the early 90s.
That was really in the middle of the crack epidemic, when courts were seeing the numbers of arrests triple and quadruple, and so the court system was overwhelmed with drug cases. And the problem with drug crimes committed by drug addicts is that they keep coming back.
The court was set up to treat rather than punish. Clients are offered mental health services, job training, and education opportunities. There are also extracurricular activities like a reading club and a basketball team started by case manager Leroy West Spicer. West Spicer has his own history with basketball and addiction.
Well, I played high school ball, and I graduated in 78. Then I got a scholarship to Minot State University in North Dakota. And I played 10 months in Winnipeg, Canada, semi-pro basketball before I broke my leg. And then that's where, you know, everything ended in the professional level for me.
After he broke his leg, Wes Spicer returned to Staten Island, where he eventually coached high school basketball. But basketball took a back seat to drugs and alcohol. And after 4 years, Wes Spicer says he hit bottom.
Bottom looks like when you're sleeping on a Staten Island ferry because you don't want to go home, and you would lie to your wife and say that you're working overnight and just coming up with excuses. You know, you start to lose your energy after a while because, you know, you have to lie so much you couldn't keep up with the lies.
Then came the intervention and rehab. He pulled his life together. And when the Brooklyn Treatment Court opened in 1996, he jumped at the opportunity to help others struggling with addiction. In 2008, he decided to challenge two of the Brooklyn Treatment Court clients to a pickup basketball game. 40 clients showed up the day of the game.
After a couple of drills, we had a water break. And on the sidelines, guy just started opening up.
Wes Spicer saw an opportunity to work lessons into his practice drills.
After we do a drill, let's just say it's a give and go drill, right? And then we use that metaphor, and then we say, okay, what is that drill represent in your real life happenings?
When Rasheen Little entered the Brooklyn Treatment Court in 2011, he forged an immediate connection with Wes Spicer.
Well, with Rasheen, I seen me. He came into my cube, and he didn't know anything about me. And if you look at my cube, my history is on my wall, you know. So he started looking around. He says, oh, Spice, you play ball?
The year Little joined the team, they won their league's championship.
He was just like the smallest guy on the team, but he had the knowledge. Like he, you know, there's some guys that play the game just by playing, but he can play the game, and he's a student of the game. So that's what makes him, you know, I guess a good coach.
Shots fired.
After Little graduated from the Brooklyn Treatment Court, he and Wes Spicer kept in touch. Now, they're working together with the children's basketball team. On a Saturday in October, Little is preparing his team for a match.
Team on three, war on six, y'all. One, two, three.
Team.
Four, five, six.
War.
Come on, y'all, wake up. Listen.
It's the first of two games that day. They lose both. The first one is by a single point. Little calls the loss growing pains. He's optimistic that the losses will prepare them for better things.
Oh, yeah, we got to grow up. It's growing pains. It's part of the things that the kids go through. That's the only how we're going to get better, bigger, and stronger. And when their time comes, our time will come as a whole organization.
There will be more games to come this season and more chances to win. Little and Wes Spicer know from their time at the Brooklyn Treatment Court that another chance is everything. For City in Demand, I'm Topher Forges.
For more from Topher Forges in the City in Demand series, you can check out City in Demand on Facebook. If you went to Fordham University, there's a good chance you never heard this sound. The school is known for producing legendary football coach Vince Lombardi, but in recent years, the Fordham Rams have had a record of failure. Entire classes of Fordham University students have graduated without seeing a winning season. Until now, Ronald Chavez reports.
We have some skirt steak tacos over here. We have chicken wings. We have burgers, dogs. I saw some wraps over there.
A lot of people are tailgating, which is special to this game. I haven't really seen it before.
Fordham's going to take it home.
We're going to take it home, absolutely.
Yeah.
Here it is, the biggest test of the season so far. Like Fordham, Lehigh is undefeated. This game could answer the question, is this team for real? The parking lot is a mess of fold-out tables. Students drink out of red Solo cups. Their parents join them. And everyone wears the team color, maroon.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, Fordham, we haven't had a real winning season like this in so long.
2 years ago, they finished their season with just one win. This year, the Rams have won each of their first eight games. For the first time ever, they're 8-0. They're beating schools they've never beaten before, like college football powerhouse Villanova.
I think they're just working really well together, and because they're doing so well, more kids are going to the games, and I think just the morale is all boosted, and we're all really into it now.
A new coach, a skilled junior quarterback, and legions of new fans all mark Fordham's football revival. This is especially exciting for Andy Lukak. He's part of Fordham's storied history. He played under famed coach Vince Lombardi in the late 1940s. He was team captain in 1950, and in 1992, the school inducted him to the team's Hall of Fame. Lukak says Lombardi was tough.
Oh, well, you had to do your job. Put it that way. He was very diligent. And you had to be diligent. You had to do your job. And he knew if you were goofing off. If you were goofing off, you were on a sideline.
But this team is not goofing off. They haven't just won. The Rams have been crushing the league.
So I have three kids in college, and my wife and I are very proud. But to see my son on Fordham, born and raised in the Bronx, native New Yorker. Family was here when they all got here. We're very proud. Very proud.
As for those Fordham students, they were riding high, and they had a harsh message for Lehigh. At Fordham University in the Bronx, I'm Ronald Chavez.
If you want to see if the Rams can make it 9-0 on Saturday, November 2nd, head to the Bronx when Fordham plays Holy Cross at home. Our Guys is the moniker of singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Greg Donahue. He's a classically trained musician and self-described hired gun. Donahue's played with groups like MGMT and Vampire Weekend, but last year Donahue teamed up with a friend to release his own brand of indie rock. Our Guys joins us in the studio now. Greg, welcome to Audiophiles.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've been working on new songs for your second release. Do you mind if you start us off by playing one?
Sure. This one's we're gonna be releasing some new songs in just a couple of weeks, so this will be one of them. It's called Steady As She Goes.
Lately I've been looking for a way out on this earth and maybe in the clouds, and it's all I can think about. Steady as she goes, someone's gonna catch me on the way down. Take this fall and turn it around. The Peace Corps looking better now. Steady as she goes. Baby, I know I've been out of sight. If I could just get paid, I'll make it right. Nobody said love was a fair fight, but we were born for this. If you told me as a younger man that it was true, money does everything you ask it to, well, I would have laughed and cried for you. Steady as she goes. Lately I've been working on a new song, a pretty little number to sing along. It's something about a girl who hung on. It's called Steady as She Goes. Baby, I know I've been out of sight. If I could just get paid, I'll make it right. Nobody said love was a fair fight, but we were born for this. Get paid, I'll make it right. Nobody said love was a fair fight, but we were born for this. Lately I've been working on a new song, a pretty little number to sing along. Something about a girl who hung on. Steady as she goes.
Thank you so much. That was Our Guys' Greg Donahue performing Steady as She Goes on Audiophiles. Also backing up Greg is singer Anna Hendricks. Greg, Anna, thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. So I hear Our Guys was born out of a DIY sort of pet project and with a college friend. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So Joaquin Kotler and I, who's that friend, have just been playing in a lot of bands together and with other people since college. And it was sort of stemmed out of not working on any of our own stuff. So I had written a bunch of songs, brought them to him. We started recording them, and it took months, but over piecemeal in recording things in closets and in bedrooms and also at studios when we were lucky and had generous friends.
So what were some of your goals for the band when you started?
I don't know. It's like the goals for any band when it starts, I guess. It was like a particular outlet at a time, at that time, which was good. And I was sort of tired of playing other people's music for a really long time, which is what I had been doing for a couple of years. And it was great experiences, but, ready to do my own thing, so.
Sure. And how has your band evolved since you released your EP last year? What are your goals now?
Well, the goals are probably still the same, which I'm hesitant to mention, but, I just want to keep building it as best I can. But it's changed in that it's now become sort of a rotating cast of musicians and friends who are generous with their time to come play shows, like Anna and still Joaquin playing all the time, and many other people who are making appearances.
Well, I know you have an upcoming EP coming out. Can you play another one of your new songs?
Yeah, sure. This is sort of a lullaby called Light of the Moon. You asked if I could take it slow, and I told you that I would. That was a lifetime ago.
I was scared to let that touch feel right. Thank God you took me by the hands, showed me the stars at night.
Knew I was leaving too soon. Knew I was leaving too soon. I was gone before you even knew. Gone by the light of the moon.
Never let me down like I thought you would. You were really something then, and knew it better than I ever could.
Oh, but I still got songs to sing through the night. Can't just listen through the wall till the sunrise. I was leaving too soon. And who I was leaving too soon. I was gone before you even knew. Gone by the light. By the light of the moon.
Thank you so much. That was Greg Donahue from Our Guys with Light of the Moon. Backing him up is Anna Hendricks. Greg, I know you have a pretty diverse musical background. I hear that you play a lot of different instruments. Can you tell me a little bit about your training and how many instruments do you exactly play?
I play bass and guitar sort of, professionally, I guess, is the way to put it. I can sort of handle myself a lot of most of the string instruments at this point, at least in some kind of like backing effect. And my training in that is in classical double bass. So I'm sort of coming from that originally.
And so I know you're classically trained in music. How have your tastes sort of evolved around over the years? What are you into now? What are you listening to?
Well, excuse me. Always tons of different stuff. Always. Right now, trying to listen to a lot of world music, I guess, is the thing. I don't know, music from around the world. And also always listening to a lot of folk music I've developed as I've gotten older, I think, an appreciation for like a really well-written song as opposed to, somebody who can just wail on their instrument.
Okay.
So, which is, an admirable thing and really awesome sometimes. But I think what I'm looking for now when I'm looking at and listening and looking for music that's really like saying something, it's really a kind of tight, well-structured and, well-done songwriting. So,
do you try to do that in your own music?
Yeah, I try to do that, yeah.
On that note, can we hear one last song from you guys?
Yeah, sure. This one will also be on these new recordings that come out in a few weeks. So it's called Better Mistakes.
I hope that someday a man comes your way who's got all, kept you looking. But if you never find the man in your mind, know that my heart's for the taking. Oh, my father once told me about a woman in need should tie you down when you've got the notion to leave. So I cast my belongings and my heart to the sea. And when the devil comes, he'll take nothing from me. And all I want, and all I need from you is to not hesitate. And all I want, and all I need from you is to make bitter mistakes. I saw a girl fall in love on the street yesterday, tucked under her arm an empty picture frame. She smiled and she laughed, and like the wind she blew past, tired of being alone. You're too good for New York anyway. Stay where the sun shines gold in the day. Oh, cause it's black as the night here when noon's on its way. And you're lying, you're too good for this town. And all I want, and all I need from you is to not hesitate. And all I want, and all I need from you is to make better mistakes. Well, I hope that someday a man comes your way who's got all, who's kept you looking. But if you never find the man in your mind, know that my heart's for the taking.
That was Our Guys. You can hear them perform live tonight and next Wednesday at Pete's Candy Store at 10 p.m. Greg, Anna, thank you so much for coming by the studio.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to Audiophiles. This show was produced by Mary Eileen Croak. Tiffany Kamhai is our assistant producer, and Ronald Chavez is our online producer. Our engineer is Chad Bernhard. I'm Ellie Yu. Thanks for listening. Whoa.
Feather hanging down like bullets from your brain. Summer spirit lost, now drowned amongst the waves. Whoa.
Okay, kids, gather around. I know we haven't discussed this in a while, but who remembers where we're all going to meet in case of an emergency?
I do. Grand Central Station.
Times Square.
No, silly. Higher ground.
Where's that?
The mountains, son.
But we live in the city.
Right. Good point.
What about supplies and all that other stuff?
Don't you even worry. Your mom has all those canned beets somewhere in the apartment.
Oh, I just remembered. I also have canned cocktail onions.
What about water?
We have a few gallons stored in the basement.
But we don't have a basement.
He means the storage unit.
Where's that?
32nd and 7th.
Great. Sounds like we don't have a plan. What time's the game on?
Winging It is not an emergency plan. Make sure your kids know what to do during an emergency. Who to call, where to meet, what to pack. Search Ready Kids at nyc.gov or call 311. A public service announcement brought to you by the New York City Office of Emergency Management and the Ad Council.